sessions and attended roundtables with Native leaders. But it wasn't until August of 2008 that I was invited to a powwow by the Red Lake Band of Chippewa. The Red Lake Reservation is a good 250 miles north of the Twin Cities and is the poorest 1,200 square miles in our state, with tremendously high rates of unemployment. Its population of around 5,100 has seen more than its share of tragedy. In 2005, a 15-year-old boy shot and killed his grandfather and his grandfather's girlfriend, then went to his old school and killed seven others before committing suicide. But a powwow is a happy occasion, a celebration of cultural heritage. Excited, I sat down with Peggy Flanagan, a half Ojibwe 20-something Minneapolis school board member who was advising me on Indian issues and who is now a Minnesota state legislator. Peggy had about a half an hour to prepare me for my first powwow. Okay, don't call them costumes. They're wearing regalia. I wasn't planning on calling them anything, I said, but okay, regalia. And don't dance, Peggy told me definitively. Don't dance. Don't dance. Why shouldn't I dance? Governor Pawlenty danced a couple years ago, and they haven't stopped making fun of him, she said with a half grin. Okay, don't dance. Don't dance. Now, Indians volunteer for military service at a higher rate than any other group in the country. I didn't know that, I said. And they respect their warriors, so the drums will start, and then the warriors will lead in their traditional regalia. Regalia, I got it, I nodded. But they'll also be wearing their veterans' caps and carrying flags. Right, sure. And after the veterans, the others will come out in their regalia, and everyone dances around the circle to the drums, and they'll dance a number of dances. And should I dance? Peggy knew me well enough to ignore this. Now, after the dances, the drums will stop, and everyone will go to sit in the bleachers, and Chairman Jourdain will introduce you. Okay. So what do you plan to say, she asked. I realized that I hadn't given that a lot of thought, but tried out some of what I had learned. Well, I guess I'd say to them that because of the cultural trauma that your people have gone through, you've experienced a lot of pathologies like chemical dependency and domestic violence. Yeah, they've heard that, Peggy said matter-of-factly. They're going to expect you to be funny. Well, that took me a little by surprise. Peggy wasn't with the campaign full-time, but she'd been involved enough to know our key strategic objective. We're trying to get away from the funny, I reminded her. Peggy nodded. I know, but they're going to expect you to be funny. And after you speak, there'll be more dancing. Don't dance. Peggy couldn't come on the six-hour drive to Red Lake the next day, and while I felt I had internalized her instructions, I was frankly pretty nervous about my remarks. I had never spoken to a large Indian audience before, and I wanted to let them know that I'd given some serious thought to their issues. But I trusted Peggy. On the drive up, I told Chris that I decided I'd just have to read the crowd and go with my gut. Chris and I arrived at Red Lake just in time and drove right to the powwow grounds. The arena was a set of concentric circles. In the middle was a circular gazebo, and around it a wide dirt circle for dancing. All around the outside of the dance circle were drums, which provided the rhythm for the dancing. The drummers would sing traditional Ojibwe songs as well. The outside circle was comprised of bleachers, where a good crowd of spectators had gathered for the festivities. The drums started, and just as Peggy said, the veterans led in their regalia and caps from the Gulf Wars, from Vietnam and Korea. There was even one member of the Greatest Generation wearing his World War II cap. They were followed by others in their regalia, men, women, and children, dancing around the outdoor arena. I stood on the outside of the dancing circle, enjoying myself, at least until a middle-aged man danced up to me and said, "Why don't you come in and dance?" He danced in place, motioning with his arm that I should come in and join everyone. I said uncomfortably, I will respect you more if you dance, he said with great seriousness. Okay, maybe later, I said with great lameness. One nod and he moved on. I thought, as I backed away from the circle. Maybe I should have had Peggy come with me. Or maybe I should at least have asked her what I should say if someone asked me to dance. After about 30 or 40 minutes of drumming and dancing, the sun had set, the MC announced the speaking portion of the powwow, and the dancers took their seats in the bleachers with the others. Buck Jourdain, the long-standing chairman of Red Lake, took a hand mic out to the arena under the lights. It was turning dark, and the heat of the afternoon had dissipated. The stars were out. The air was soft. It was an exquisitely beautiful northern Minnesota night. And I was very nervous. Buck started his introduction. We had met a few times before, and in the intro, he called me a friend. That meant a lot to me, because I had been really impressed with Buck. He was in his 40s, tall and handsome, with a beautiful braided ponytail, and he carried himself with strength and dignity. My friends with ponytails are mostly people in show business, aging, paunchy, bespectacled Jews, whose ponytails always seem like a desperate affectation signaling unsuccessfully that the wearer is still young and cool, despite their recent hip replacement. But on Buck, the ponytail looked good. Buck gave me a small man hug and passed me the mic to polite applause. I took in the crowd for a moment, trying to get a read from the faces. Not much of anything. I thanked Buck and told the crowd they had a great chairman. I started in on how the federal government was failing to meet its treaty obligations in terms of fully funding Indian education and health care, and how if I won, I'd hope to be on the Indian Affairs Committee and fight to change that. No reaction. Peggy was right. They'd heard this before. They're gonna expect you to be funny. I decided to call an audible. So I guess if we don't fulfill our treaty obligations, we should just give you all your land back and call it even. That got something of a laugh and a few nods. And as far as education, I guess other Americans need to know that Indians are a contemporary people who like to celebrate their culture just like every other group. For example, I'm Jewish. This got exactly the reaction I was hoping for. Nothing. Let me try that again, I said, feigning offense. I'm Jewish. Laughter, applause, and cheering. My God, I thought, Peggy's a genius. And Jews like to celebrate our own heritage, just like you're doing today. The crowd was nodding and smiling, and in that very instant, I figured out the whole dancing thing. Now, earlier, a gentleman asked me to dance. Well, I'll make a deal with you. I will dance, but only if you all agree not to make fun of me after I leave. More laughter. So, I need a show of hands. How many agree not to make fun of me after I leave if I dance? Everyone looked around at each other, and about two-thirds of the crowd raised their hands. That's not enough, I said. I need everyone to raise their hands. More laughs, and sure enough, every single person there raised a hand. All right, I grinned, thinking how silly it was that I'd been so nervous. Why, I've got them in the palm of my hand. I will dance. That's when one of the drummers hit his drum, joined on the second beat by another, then another, until all the drummers were drumming. Often what makes a really good joke a really good joke is that a number of ideas come together simultaneously. The moment that that first drummer hit his drum, he brought together several amusing notions. First, that for whatever reason, I clearly had serious qualms about dancing. Second, that those qualms had something to do with my fear of being made fun of. Third, that I thought those fears would magically disappear if everyone agreed not to make fun of me after I left. And finally, that number three was based on my mistaken assumption that I would be dancing along with everyone else and not by myself in front of the entire crowd, plus cell phone cameras. So it was a really good joke, and it was on me. Everyone in the bleachers was laughing at the drummer's very clever joke and staring at me, waiting for me to start dancing. How did I get myself into this? I thought. The drummers kept up the beat, the crowd grinning expectantly. Fortunately, I had paid attention after I told the gentleman that I might dance, and so I began, two shuffles from my left foot, two shuffles from my right foot, trying to stay in rhythm. As I started around the circle, I kept my head down, trying unsuccessfully to block out the crowd's reaction, which I would describe as delighted amusement. I looked up to the bleachers and gave a smile as if to share in the merriment and show that I was a good sport, but I'm afraid I wasn't hiding my embarrassment and, as I recall, self-loathing. My own cultural heritage was on display as well. About a quarter away around the circle, a little girl, I'd say 4 or 5 years old, jumped up and bailed me out. She grabbed my hand, and the two of us danced a little further until another child came in and took my other hand. And then another and another and another. The night was beautiful again. The adults came in, and we all danced under the moon and stars. And I became kind of a dancing fool. 4 or 5 dances later, a woman sidled up to me and said, "You dance like a white guy." "What about the deal?" I asked. "The deal was after you leave," she smiled. At the end of the powwow, Buck approached me. I talked with the rest of the tribal council, and they all agreed that we've never had a politician here who knows how to read a crowd as well as you. I was flattered. Of course, it was a good bet that I was the only politician to visit Red Lake who had spent 35 years in show business, but also I had to laugh because the whole thing had lurched so badly out of control before landing on its feet. Buck took me by the arm and said, "I'd like to introduce you to my son and his friend who's in the Army." We walked out to the parking lot where we found the two young men leaning up against an old beat-up car. We all shook hands, and I asked the friend, "How long have you been in the Army?" "Oh, I was only there about a month," he shrugged. "I got kicked out because I can't see very well." I was puzzled. You're not wearing glasses." He just shrugged. The Army was going to make me glasses, but they didn't. I was confused. What's wrong with your eyesight?" "I don't know," he said. All of this was well outside my life experience. I asked an obvious question. Have you gone to the eye doctor?" "Oh, we don't have an eye doctor," he said. One of the best things about running for office is that if you do it right, you learn a lot about stuff you very likely would never have discovered otherwise. One of the worst things about running for office is that if you do it right, you're constantly switching gears. As soon as you're done with one thing, you're off to another, which leaves you almost no time to process the stuff you just learned about. Leaving the powwow, I was overwhelmed, both with gratitude at how welcoming and generous Buck and the Red Lake community had been, and with shame at the conditions in which so many First Americans were living. But as Chris was in charge of reminding me, even in the car, there was more work to do, more phone calls to make, more notes to write, more events to prepare for. A candidate who's sitting around thinking is a candidate who's losing. In fact, the day after the powwow, I had to fly right off to New York for a couple of fundraisers in the richest place in America, the Hamptons. The Hamptons are the summer home of the top 1/10 of the top 1%. The ones with the waterfront estates are the members of the top 1/10 of the top 1/10 of the top 1%. The ones with the nicest, biggest waterfront estates and the richest Hampton of them all, Rich Hampton, are members of the top 1/10 of the top 1/10 of the top 1/10 of the top 1%. The top 1,000th percent. Every one of these people can go to an eye doctor pretty much any time they want, or more likely, have an eye doctor brought to them for a full examination. There at this lovely home in Rich Hampton with delicious food and wine, and surrounded by people with flawlessly corrected vision, wearing the latest designer regalia, I felt that my donors needed to hear about Red Lake. So I told them the story I've just told you. I didn't tell them the end of the story, though, because the ending hadn't happened yet. When I got to the Senate, I got that seat on the Indian Affairs Committee, because in the Senate, anyone who wants to be on Indian Affairs gets on Indian Affairs. One of the things I fought hard for was allowing Indian tribal courts to prosecute non-Indians who commit acts of domestic violence. I was also able to get funding to replace the dilapidated, structurally unsafe high school on the Leech Lake Reservation in Minnesota. We passed a new Indian Health Care Improvement Act, and Red Lake now has an eye doctor. But the conditions in Indian country in terms of education, infrastructure, housing, and health care are still by and large disgraceful. The good news is that folks in Rich Hampton are doing better than ever. Chapter 18. Tax Dodging, Rape Joking, Pornographer for Senate. Norm Coleman had a problem. When he'd first gotten to the Senate in 2003, President Bush was extremely popular. That's why when he apologized for saying he was a 99% improvement over Paul Wellstone, Norm explained that he meant a 99% improvement in terms of supporting George W. Bush. He happily fell in line as a loyal Bush ally, supporting the president's agenda at every turn, and serving as one of his attack dogs in the so-called Truth Squad during the 2004 campaign against John Kerry. But then Democrats had taken back Congress in the wave election of 2006, and with President Bush's approval rating circling the drain, Coleman had begun eagerly seeking out opportunities to vote with Democrats on meaningless procedural matters. Tip O'Neill had a line about politicians like Norm who feigned at bipartisanship. He's always there when we don't need him. The upshot of all this was, when it came time to face the voters again in 2008, Norm's record consisted of 4 years of sucking up to President Bush, 2 years of running away from him, and not much in the way of actual accomplishments on behalf of the people of Minnesota. But that was okay, because Norm's best argument for being reelected, the core message of his campaign, wasn't about him. It was about me. Specifically, Al Franken is an angry, divisive, profane, tax-dodging, rape-joking pornographer. Winning the DFL endorsement had been a 16-month marathon from my announcement to the convention. The general election, on the other hand, would be a 21-week sprint to Election Day. And while earning the support of DFL delegates had been a slow, methodical process of building and organizing, the race was about to turn into a chaotic festival of mudslinging. For Stephanie Shriok, getting our campaign ready for the nastiness to come started with establishing her authority, which she did instantly with her mere presence. Being a campaign manager, I've come to realize, isn't just about managing a staff and a budget. It's about managing a candidate. Indeed, the most important cubic foot in any campaign is the one inside the candidate's skull. And as messed up as that cubic foot had been during what I unaffectionately call porn and rape joke week, the calm aura of order Shriok created reshuffled my emotional deck. And just in time, too. You see, the DSCC had gotten cold feet in the wake of the near disaster at the convention. In early July, Shriok got wind that someone had been polling in Minnesota, testing the names of two other potential DFL candidates, attorney Kathleen Flynn Peterson and former Governor Arnie Carlson, who was actually a moderate Republican but had been left behind when his party lurched to the right. Yes, I already had the DFL endorsement, but anyone who filed for the race by the deadline on July 15th would appear on the primary ballot in September. And the fact that this poll was in the field suggested that someone was interested in finding out whether a DFLer who took the extraordinary step of jumping into the race at the last minute could successfully knock off the party-endorsed candidate in the primary. When Chuck called me to acknowledge that, indeed, the DSCC was shopping for a new candidate, I happened to be in San Francisco helping to raise money for, yep, the DSCC. I really didn't know what to say, but it was some serious chutzpah on Chuck's part, and Shriok went appropriately berserk. If you ever do anything like that again, she told the DSCC's executive director, J.B. Persh, in a phone call, I will destroy you. It may not be now, but someday. Shriok can be scary, but the truth was scarier. As the general election got underway, I was down by anywhere from 8 to 14 points, depending on the poll. Shriok and I flew out to D.C. for another awkward meeting with Chuck and Harry. Harry was in a bad mood. But when we showed him a poll we'd done, which suggested that telling voters about some of Norm's ethics lapses, such as a sweetheart deal he'd been getting from a Republican fixer on his D.C. apartment, could bring me back to a tie, he grumpily acknowledged that it was a pretty good hit. Then he departed, leaving us with Chuck. We could pull to within 5 points by Labor Day, we promised him, but it would take everything we had. We'd have to empty our war chest just to get close. Would the DSCC be willing to then carry us over the finish line? Chuck wanted to say yes, but what if our strategy didn't work? What if I wasn't within five by Labor Day? Would I be willing to drop out? I said I had to call Franny and stepped into another room. She was pissed. I told her, honey, it's okay. They haven't even asked Kathleen or Arnie whether they're interested in running. No one's going to jump in by the 15th. Even if I don't get within 5 by Labor Day, they're still going to be stuck with me. So it's a bluff, she asked. Exactly. Okay. And who's bluffing, us or them? Good question. I think both of us, I answered. I'm very proud of you, honey, Franny laughed. And then I went back in the room and made the deal. That summer, for the first time, our campaign started to look like a normal campaign. Stump speeches, press conferences, rallies, and lots and lots and lots of fundraising. We ran some positive ads, talking about my work on behalf of the troops and my ideas for reforming Washington, and many more negative ads beating up on Norm for being such a stooge for President Bush. And it worked. On August 22nd, Minnesota Public Radio released a poll showing me leading the race by one single, beautiful, life-affirming, chuck-reassuring point. Republicans realized that in order to stop my momentum, they would need to double down on their strategy of destroying me and dragging the corpse of my character through the city square. And as soon as the state fair was over, that's exactly what they set out to do. In mid-September, Minnesotans were treated to this ad, courtesy of the National Republican Senatorial Committee, the NRSC. Is Al Franken fit for office? Franken writes about committing rape. Writes pornography so vile, Democrats denounced him. His profanity-laced anger, followed by violent outbursts, he physically assaulted a protester. Then there's the $70,000 in unpaid taxes. Al Franken, degrading to women, to us all. Al Franken, frankly unfit for office. It was a masterpiece. Forget about the dehumanizer. This was the work of a dehumanizer. Portray me not just as a foul-mouthed comedian, but as an actual monster. After all, Franken writes about committing rape. Sounds an awful lot like I committed rape and then wrote about it. And physically assaulted a protester? Well, that sounds a little unsenatorial, too. It was actually a reference to an incident during the 2004 New Hampshire primaries in which I stopped a Lyndon LaRouche fanatic who was charging the stage where Howard Dean was speaking. 2 weeks later, the mayor of Manchester gave me the key to the city for helping stop the guy. To really drive home the point, the ad depicted my face with parallel lines running across it, a subtle suggestion of jail bars as if I had done time or should do time for my history of raping women and beating up dissenters. There were a lot of ads like this, as Coleman realized his only chance of winning was to reduce me to a small pile of smoking rubble. One of my favorites made use of an underrated joke from Pornorama. The internet is going to be a fabulous learning tool for kids. For example, my son used the internet to do a great sixth grade report on bestiality. He downloaded a lot of great visual aids, and the kids in the class just loved them because, you know, at that age, they're just sponges. The point of the joke, of course, was that parents should consider monitoring how their children use the internet. Pretty conservative, pro-family idea, don't you think? But then the dehumorizer got hold of it, and to the litany of horrors featured in Republican ads was added the word bestiality, zooming in at you from infinity while scary horror movie music droned over a disgusted narrator. My mother-in-law Fran cried when she saw that one. Meanwhile, we were trying to keep the focus on Norm's record. On September 22nd, the same day the NRSC ran its Franken writes about committing rape ad, we released an ad taking Coleman to task for his oversight failure as chairman of the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, an ad that began with the ominous message, "This may be the worst thing Norm Coleman's done." I held a press conference to show off the ad. We were desperate to get reporters to pay attention to the story, which I thought was a perfect illustration of how Coleman had abdicated his responsibility in favor of being a lickspittle for the Bush administration. But the press still shrugged. Somehow, the lurid intimation that I was a rapist proved more effective than my indignation over Norm's failure to perform oversight. On September 17th, we had run our first internal tracking poll. It showed me with the 1-point lead. Franken 41, Coleman 40, independent candidate Dean Barkley, who had actually served in the U.S. Senate for a few weeks in 2002 after Governor Jesse Ventura appointed him to finish Paul Wellstone's term, was at 14%. Minnesota has a proud tradition of third-party candidates. With Norm and I pounding each other daily, Barkley had a particular appeal to voters who were disgusted with both of us. Just 1 week later, on September 24th, the same poll showed me 3 points down. Coleman 41, Franken 38, Barkley 17. Still, I knew we had the debates. I was relishing the chance to get on a stage with Coleman. But once we started preparing, I found the debate format, 90-second answer, 30-second rebuttal, it just felt horribly unnatural to me. To make things worse, these debates weren't going to be the two-man debates between me and Coleman that I had been dreaming about for years. Barkley would be on the stage as well, Senator Barkley, along with Senator Coleman and Mr. Franken. My team explained to me that attacking Norm was just going to give Barkley an opportunity to say, "There they go again. Aren't you sick of all this partisan rancor? That's why Minnesota needs an independent in Washington." So we came up with a strategy. I would play golf, not tennis. In tennis, the idea is to beat the other guy. In golf, it's just about you. My goal would be to show Minnesotans who I was and that I understand who they are. I would talk about how to replace No Child Left Behind, about getting to universal health care, about a clean energy economy, about a stronger middle class. I would pick spots to contrast what I wanted to do with what Norm had failed to do, waiting till around where I was the last to speak. Meanwhile, we were still feeling the impacts of Norm's character attacks. Our October 1st tracking poll had me down 6, Coleman 40, Franken 34, Barkley 18. That's when Franny saved the campaign. Chapter 19, Franny Saves the Campaign. Franny had never discussed her alcoholism publicly. Part of the disease is the shame that comes with it. She had shared her story only with a few close friends, including those she had met in AA. It's called Alcoholics Anonymous for a reason. Traveling around the state, Franny could see the toll that all the attack ads on my character was taking, and it was making her mad. She knew very well that the guy they depicted was not the guy she had married and raised 2 children with. Franny wanted to tell Minnesotans who I really was. She insisted on sitting down with Mandy and a camera crew. Mandy interviewed Franny in our living room for over an hour, and Franny spoke honestly and openly about her disease. And while the vicious attack ads from the Republicans had made Franny's mom cry, the ad Mandy and her team cut together still makes me cry whenever I see it. In fact, when Chuck Schumer saw it, he called me to say that he had cried, and also that he thought it would win me the election. The ad is very simple. Franny sitting on a couch, talking to an off-camera Mandy, intercut with photos of me and Franny as we've gone through the years, with photos of our beautiful daughter and son and our family. Here's the text. I first met Al at a freshman dance in college, and it was love at first sight. We've been married now for almost 33 years, and we've been so blessed in so many ways. But we also had some bad times, and at one point in our life, I struggled with alcohol dependency. How could a mother of 2 fabulous, healthy children be an alcoholic? When I was struggling with my recovery, Al stood right by my side, and he stood up for me. After what we went through, Al wrote 2 beautiful movies, and he wrote them because he wanted to help people. And they're used in rehabs all over the country. The Al Franken I know stood by me through thick and thin. So I know he'll always come through for Minnesota. It was a 60-second ad, which meant it was twice as expensive to run, but you try editing that down. What blew me away the most was the line, "How could a mother of 2 fabulous, healthy children be an alcoholic?" It was so honest about the shame she had felt, and the shame that so many women with chemical dependency feel. "This ad is the best political ad of the season," wrote local TV anchor Esme Murphy on her blog. because it might just help one person see in themselves the need to get help. 2 days later, Coleman, Barkley, and I had a debate in a gymnasium with a big crowd sitting in the bleachers and in chairs on the gym floor. When Franny entered the room, she got a standing ovation. There is no question that I would have lost the election if Franny had not made that spot. The courage that it took amazes me. A couple of years later, a book came out about the 8-month recount and legal battle entitled This Is Not Florida. If you go to the index and look under Frank and Franny, the first entry is, and alcoholism. People often come up to me and tell me that I have a thankless job. But as Lorne Michaels used to say, the thing about a thankless job is that nobody thanks you. And people thank me all the time. I think it's Franny who has a thankless job. Which reminds me, I really ought to thank Franny one of these days for making that ad. You know, and all the other stuff. In that debate, the one in the gymnasium, Norm brought up my assault on the protester in Manchester, New Hampshire. When I told the crowd about getting the key to the city, they laughed. I had played a good game of golf, but by the next debate, the course had changed dramatically. All summer long, the housing market had been in turmoil. And on September 29th, the financial crisis reached a climax in the wake of Lehman Brothers going under. It took about a week for a $700 billion-plus bailout package to work its way through Congress. Coleman immediately came out for the bailout, telling voters in North Mankato that the government could make 10 or 20 times what it pays on this, possibly. It shows how out of touch he is, I told the Star Tribune. I admit that I had the luxury of not having to cast a vote during a rapidly escalating crisis. But I felt that the bailout as proposed did little to protect taxpayers and nothing for homeowners who were the victims of the malfeasance of so many of those who were being bailed out. I said I'd vote for a package that had ownership stakes for taxpayers and companies seeking relief, the creation of a financial product safety commission, protections for homeowners, like allowing bankruptcy lawyers to adjust mortgages in order to prevent foreclosures, and no bonuses or golden parachutes for executives. At that next debate, which was televised nationally, the bailout became the centerpiece of the discussion. Norm asked how I could have opposed a bailout that Senators Amy Klobuchar and Barack Obama had both voted for. I guess maybe, I offered, a maverick. As the audience laughed, Norm responded a little uncomfortably and more oddly, considering that his party's nominee that year was Senator John McCain. I guess Minnesota should decide if they want a maverick in the Senate. Franken internal poll, October 1st, Coleman 40, Franken 34, Barkley 18. Franken internal poll, October 8th, Franken 40, Coleman 32, Barkley 22. It's certainly possible that Norm's decision to support the bailout of Wall Street and my decision to oppose it was a factor in this swing. But in the October 1st poll, only 33% of Minnesotans reported they had a favorable opinion of me. Then came Franny's ad. And a week later, it was up to 41% favorable, with a lot of the difference coming from women. Still not exactly beloved territory, but it was a real turning point in the race. Another came that very day, October 8th. All summer, we'd been making the case that Norm was kind of shady, pointing to the sweetheart deal he'd gotten on that apartment in D.C., as well as a long litany of trips he'd taken to exotic destinations like Paris and the Bahamas, all paid for by special interests with business before the government. This was technically legal, but nearly 50 trips over his first term at a cost of nearly $100,000 spoke to a guy who was way too close to powerful interests. In fact, the Center for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington awarded him an honorable mention in their list of the most corrupt people in Washington, a list, by the way, that included both Democrats and Republicans. In early October, a reporter from Harper's Magazine had started digging in rumors that a businessman named Nazar Kazmini, who had flown Norm around the world on his private plane, had also bought Norm some suits. The Senate requires you to report gifts from friends. Norm had not reported being gifted any suits. It was curious, to say the least. On October 8th, when Coleman campaign manager Colin Sheen called a press conference to attack me for some unrelated nonsense, the reporter pounced, asking whether there was any truth to the rumor. The senator, Sheen said, has reported every gift he's ever received. That wasn't my question, the reporter responded, but Sheen gave the exact same answer. The senator has reported every gift he's ever received. So Senator Coleman's friend has not bought these suits for him, is that correct? The senator, Sheen repeated, has reported every gift he's ever received. Colin Sheen never actually answered the question of whether Kazmini had bought Coleman any suits, but over the next few minutes, he would go on to repeat the same oddly legalistic answer nearly a dozen times. It couldn't have been more clear that something was up. The video went viral, making a round of the national blogs. I was as curious as anyone as to whether there was some big scandal lurking here, but I was also looking forward to what we had planned for the next day, October 9th. Many of the Republican ads that summer had featured a particular clip of me, my face contorted, my arms waving, I'm practically jumping up and down, and I look like I'm having a temper tantrum. It's not my best look. But I recognized that clip, and I knew exactly where they had gotten it. Paul Wellstone had been an amazingly passionate guy with extraordinary energy. He'd always end his speeches with an astounding burst of enthusiasm that brought crowds to their feet. Democrats in the state loved it and always waited in eager anticipation for him to rock it at the end. The closest thing I've experienced has been at Grateful Dead shows. Now, during the campaign, my friend David Wellstone, one of Paul and Sheila's sons, spent some time touring the state with me. One day I asked David a question that had been on my mind for a few years. David, I've heard this thing about your dad, and I wanted to ask you. I heard that he had so much energy that when you kids played soccer, he'd run up and down the sidelines, following the ball back and forth, up and down the field. Is that true? Yeah, Dave nodded, but get this. I ran cross country. He paused for effect. He didn't. David nodded again. My dad used to run alongside me just off the side of the course. And about 300 yards from the finish, I'd be about 10 yards behind the leader and totally out of gas. And my dad would start yelling, "You can take this guy! You can take this guy! You can do it! You can take this guy!" Now, imagine how weird that was for the other guy. I started telling that story in my stump speech. And I'd end with running in place, wildly gesticulating, screaming, "You can take this guy! You can take this guy!" And then I'd tell the end of the story, which was David saying, "And wouldn't you know it, I'd take that guy." Then I'd exhort the crowd, "I need you to be my Paul! Will you be my Paul? Will you be my Paul?" Crowds loved that story, so I started doing it at the end of rallies. And Republicans had taken their trackers' footage of this and run it through the dehumorizer, which apparently could process body language just as efficiently as it could words. Without the sound, I looked pretty crazy. So our ad, another Saul Shore joint, simply explained what they'd done. It opened on a picture of Paul, no music. Paul Wellstone used to run alongside his son David when David was running cross-country races, began the narrator, an elderly gentleman who sounded like the guy from Pepperidge Farm commercials. Listen to Al Franken tell the story. And then the video of me telling the story with David Wellstone sitting right there and a charmed crowd grinning and chuckling at the memory of Paul. And when I got to the "you can take this guy" part, the narrator pauses the clip. "Look familiar?" he asks as a few frames from the Republican ad that had taken me out of context slid onto the screen next to me. "That's right. Ads for Norm Coleman use footage of Al Franken telling this story about Paul Wellstone and his son and tried to make it seem like he was angry." It's not uncommon to see one ad debunking another ad, but this one felt different. With no music, no hyperventilating narration, no flashy graphics, and a tone that suggested it was more in sadness than in anger, it was, in a way, an ad not just about one deliberate mischaracterization, but about the entire rotten campaign Republicans had run against me. If they could lie about me telling a story about my late friend, a story that was about his positive energy and his enthusiasm and his spirit, then what else were they lying about? Could we trust anything they said? And what did it say about Norm that this is how he was hoping to keep his job? Minnesota deserves better, the ad concluded. And I think Coleman must have realized Minnesotans would agree, because the very next day, he announced that he was going to pull down all of his negative ads and run a purely positive campaign the rest of the way. He explained that he had come to this decision over the recent Yom Kippur holiday. Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, is the holiest day on the Jewish calendar. And Norm had evidently had an epiphany. I decided I was not all that interested in returning to Washington for another 6 years based on the judgment of voters that I was not as bad as the other guys. I want folks to vote for me and not against the other folks. It was probably just a coincidence that a recent poll had shown that by a more than 2-to-1 margin, voters blamed Norm more than me for the negative tone of the race. And it was probably just a coincidence that this was happening the day after we'd busted him, telling a particularly ugly lie about my Paul Wellstone impersonation. And it was probably just a coincidence that 2 days earlier, his campaign manager had signaled to the world that there was likely a major ethics scandal brewing in Norm's closet. We were incredulous. It's like an arsonist burning down every house in the village and then asking to be named fire chief, we told the press. But incredibly, his claptrap seemed to be working, and our lead began to dwindle. Franken internal poll, October 15th. Franken 39, Coleman 32, Barkley 24. Franken internal poll, October 21st. Franken 39, Coleman 35, Barkley 21. Franken internal poll, October 23rd. Franken 40, Coleman 37, Barkley 18. Chapter 20. Has it gotten that bad? On October 25th, I woke up in a bad mood. At a debate the night before, I had gone around and around with Coleman and Barkley on the subject of guns. It was the same argument Democrats and Republicans always have. They insisted that I wanted to take everyone's guns away. I insisted that I didn't. Now, Minnesota is a fairly pro-gun state. A lot of Minnesotans hunt deer and pheasants in particular, but the Frankens didn't. Dad had taken me and Owen fishing, but not hunting. In fact, the first time I ever shot a gun was during the campaign. Congressman Colin Peterson from rural western Minnesota, chairman of the House Agriculture Committee, had invited me to go pheasant hunting in October 2007, and I couldn't very well say no. But this was a mere year and a half after Vice President Cheney had shot his 78-year-old lawyer friend Harry Whittington in the face while hunting quail. If Cheney, an avid lifelong hunter, could shoot a friend in the face while bird hunting, wasn't it possible, even likely, that I could shoot Colin, whom I barely knew, in the face? That wouldn't help my campaign at all. So I bought a shotgun and went to a range to shoot clay pigeons a couple of times. The day before the hunt, my team gave me a brief. It was a picture of a pheasant and said, shoot this, and then a picture of Colin, not this. Mission accomplished. I bagged a couple of pheasants that beautiful fall day, and Colin's face emerged entirely intact. Anyway, I told this story during the debate, but Coleman was still trying to paint me as a gun grabber, the kind of lie that, as you may recall from my previous books, drives me nuts. So I was kind of cranky the next morning as I was rushing out the door for a full day of campaigning. Suddenly, it occurred to me that there would be media at some of my events. I stopped in my tracks. Playing out in my mind, I realized that a member of the press might ask me if I really owned a shotgun. And then to trick me, they might ask me the brand of the gun, which I could not remember for the life of me. What if they ask and I say Remington when I really own a, oh my God, I don't even know the name of another shotgun. This could be a disaster. What kind of Minnesotan doesn't know the make of his own shotgun? Certainly not one who expects to represent the state in the United States Senate. Wait, Winchester? This kind of confused thinking takes time, and by now I was running late. But I just had to check on my shotgun, which we kept upstairs in the guest room closet for suicidal guests. My 85-year-old mother-in-law, the one who cried when she saw the commercial that suggested I was into bestiality, was staying with us for the remainder of the campaign. I ran up the stairs and knocked on her door. "Fran?" Remember, Franny's a junior. "Fran, are you decent?" "What?" Fran is very hard of hearing. "Can I open the door?" I yelled. "Are you dressed?" The door swung open, my mother-in-law in a robe, looking slightly puzzled. "I need to find my gun," I shouted as I passed her, heading to the closet. "Your tie? No, no, my gun! My gun!" In the closet, I could not find the shotgun, which I had left unloaded, standing upright in a corner. The shotgun was gone. "Your gun?" my mother-in-law asked. "Yes, my gun. I can't find my gun." I was frantic. Finding my gun was supposed to take seconds. Now my campaign was one question away from crashing and burning, and I was going to be late for my first event. I flew past Fran, out into the hallway, down the stairs, and out the door. Moments later, my distraught mother-in-law came downstairs and found Franny in the kitchen. "Has it gotten that bad?" she cried. "Has it gotten so bad that Al has to carry a gun?" By this point, Barack Obama had opened up a significant lead over John McCain, and Democratic Senate candidates around the country were on the rise as well. My race seemed to be one of the few where things were getting hairier and hairier, so a lot of national Democrats volunteered to come to Minnesota to help out by holding big rallies. Big rallies look great on TV, of course, and guarantee you coverage in the newspaper, which is great. But there are also opportunities to build your Get Out the Vote program. You station volunteers with clipboards all around the room and urge people to sign pledge cards committing to vote. Then in the days leading up to the election, you follow up and make sure people follow through. The Clintons were champs. Hillary came to Minneapolis on October 21st for a huge afternoon rally at the University of Minnesota. Then Bill for another at the Minneapolis Convention Center on October 30th, the Thursday before the election. That weekend, with our numbers on the Iron Range looking shaky, we called Hillary and asked her to come back. She saw how close the race looked and agreed to come to Duluth for another rally to help get me over the top. But one person who had no interest in providing that help was Barack Obama. I believe President Obama has been a hero, one of the best leaders this country has ever had, a man of incredible grace and bountiful intelligence, who has made real progress for America and deserves to go down in history as one of our very best presidents. But candidate Obama, or at least the Obama campaign, was extremely unhelpful. After our Minneapolis rally, Hillary was heading up to the range for a rally for Obama in Hibbing. Amy and I joined her on the flight. Only the Obama campaign wouldn't allow me on the stage, so Hillary and Amy and Congressman Jim Oberstar would just point to me and say nice things about me, and I'd stand up in the crowd and wave. Awkward. Over and over again, we asked the Obama campaign to come to Minnesota to hold a big rally or hold a small rally or to land his damn plane at the airport, even one time so the newspaper could have a picture of me standing next to the incredibly popular president in waiting. No dice. When on October 31st he landed in Des Moines, just a short hop from Rochester, Minnesota, it almost seemed like he was going out of his way to avoid me. On October 28th, a week before the election, our tracking poll found me up by 5. Franken 41, Coleman 36, Barkley 19. The next day, October 29th, it was a 3-point lead. Franken 40, Coleman 37, Barkley 18. That day, a weird thing happened. Norm was leaving a campaign event in St. Cloud when, out of nowhere, two men jumped out of the bushes and started chasing him to his car. Does that sound like the kind of Jason Bourne-style action that this narrative has been in desperate need of all along? Well, sorry, they weren't secret agents sent to retrieve a microchip. They were reporters from the Star Tribune. In fact, they were investigative reporters, guys like the team in Spotlight who dig into big scandals. and boy, did they have a doozy of a scandal to ask Norm about. Their story ran the next day, Thursday, October 30th. It explained that earlier that week, a lawsuit had been filed in Texas by Paul McKim, the former CEO of an oil and gas services company called Deep Marine Technology, DMT, alleging that the controlling shareholder of DMT had improperly diverted company resources. That controlling shareholder? Nasser Kazmini. Yep. The guy who had flown Norm around the world on vacation and also bought him suits. And that improper diversion of company resources? A payoff to Norm Coleman. The lawsuit alleged that Kazmini had funneled money to Coleman through a Minneapolis insurance firm where Coleman's wife, Lori, worked in a no-show job as an insurance consultant, despite the fact that she had no experience in the field of insurance. McKim said that the chief financial officer of DMT had relayed a conversation in which Kazmini explained that, quote, U.S. senators don't make shit, and detailed a plan to send the Colemans $25,000 a month. In fact, according to the lawsuit, three of these $25,000 payments went through before McKim could stop the scheme. Someone had delivered a copy of the lawsuit to the Star Tribune in an anonymous envelope. And now its two ace investigative reporters were waving copies of it at Norm Coleman, who dove into his SUV. The reporters continued to demand answers, pounding on the windows until the car peeled out. The DSCC tracker's video was striking, and so was Coleman's response. He canceled all his events that afternoon. Huh, I thought upon hearing about all this. That doesn't sound totally unlike Norm. Probably good for me, right? But of course, I had no idea of whether any of it was true, and I resolved just to keep focused on my own message. Eventually, Norm emerged to deny the allegations, which came as no surprise. What did come as a surprise to me, although I guess it shouldn't have, was that he accused me of being behind the lawsuit in the first place. Huh, I thought upon hearing that. That's insane. I'd never heard of the lawsuit or of Paul McKim or of Deep Marine Technology. And how exactly had I convinced the Republican CEO of a Texas company to file a huge lawsuit? It seemed like kind of a desperate accusation. Oh, well, I thought, people won't buy that. Our tracking poll on Thursday the 30th showed me up by two. Our tracking poll on Friday the 31st showed me up by one. The final weekend of a campaign is usually all about getting out the vote. Your final TV ads are locked in, your final rallies are set. It's just a straight-ahead sprint to the finish line. But not for us. On Saturday, November 1st, Norm did something that even I couldn't believe. He put up a hastily shot last-minute ad featuring him and Lori sitting side-by-side on their couch. Al Franken's 11th-hour attack, Norm begins sadly. Phony accusations filled with lies delivered anonymously to a Minnesota newspaper before being filed in a Texas court. A vicious personal attack on my wife. This time, Al Franken's crossed the line. It was Hall of Fame-level chutzpah. A vicious personal attack on my wife. We still had no idea whether anything in the lawsuit was true, but it certainly wasn't a personal attack, and it wasn't on Lori. It was a very serious allegation that Norm had accepted bribes, an allegation that had not come from me. Looking back at it now, I guess I can see how he might have felt like this was his only move. But at the time, I just couldn't believe the gall. The whole thing felt like a new level of ugly. This wasn't what I had signed up for. We quickly put together a response of our own in which I flat out accused Norm of lying. But stations told us it was too late to change traffic, to replace the issue-focused ads we'd been planning with this new response. Shreyak bullied them into doing it anyway. Shreyak was doing a lot of bullying that week. As materials arrived at DFL headquarters for the weekend's big get-out-the-vote push, we got a look at the door hangers that canvassers would leave for voters to discover on Election Day. Funded and approved by the Obama campaign in Chicago, They featured big pictures of Barack Obama and encouragements to vote for various down-ballot offices on the DFL ticket, but barely any mention of the Senate race. Obama had decided to basically pretend that I wasn't even on the ballot. Fortunately, the guy running the Obama campaign's Minnesota efforts was Jeff Blodgett. Shriok pleaded with him, if our campaign paid to redo the door hangers, only this time with me included prominently on them, would Jeff go rogue and use them instead of the ones he'd gotten from Chicago? Jeff agreed. The Frankenfree door hangers vanished. Then on Sunday night, November 2nd, 2 days out, we met for a final debate at the Fitzgerald Theater. I got off one good line. This is not about Norm Coleman's wife. This is about Senator Coleman's political sugar daddy. But otherwise tried to keep the focus on the issues. Everyone was on edge. Everyone was exhausted. Afterwards, Shriok and Colin Sheehan, Norm's campaign manager, found themselves together by the stage as the room emptied. What's going to happen, he asked her. I don't know, she replied. Me either, said Colin. The next day, Monday, November 3rd, we ran the very last round of our tracking poll. Coleman, 41, Franken, 39, Barkley, 14. Chapter 21. It's close. It's very close. If you've ever watched a TV show or a movie about an election, you know what election day looks like. Forests of candidate signs outside polling places, TV news trucks doing live spots, I voted stickers on everyone's lapels. But until you've been a candidate or worked on a campaign or been a Hillary Clinton supporter in 2016, it's hard to understand the peculiar kind of anxiety that takes hold as day turns to evening. You spend 2 years working yourself to exhaustion, trying to do everything right, and then, at a certain point on a fall Tuesday, it's suddenly no longer in your hands. You still carry all the emotional weight of the campaign, but there's really nothing left for you to do except pester everyone around you with the same question. What are you hearing? One person who was asking that question was Chuck Schumer. He called Shriok that morning and said he knew what was going to happen in every Senate race in the country except ours. So what's going to happen here, he asked her. It's close, Shriok had told him. It's very close. A friend of mine who worked with one of the networks heard in the late afternoon that exit polls from Minnesota were looking good for me. Very good, in fact. Like, really good. Of course, this was the same guy who, 4 years earlier, had called to tell me that the exit polls looked very good for Kerry. Howard Fineman. So, as the Frankens arrived at election night headquarters at the Crown Plaza Hotel in St. Paul, silently riding the elevator up to our suite, my optimism was tempered with an equal dose of pessimism. Very fitting for what lay ahead. As the polls began closing in the east, with states like New Hampshire, Pennsylvania, and Virginia going for Barack Obama, it was quickly becoming clear that this would be an especially bad night for racists all across the country. 8 years later, they would make an extraordinary comeback. The networks quickly started calling races, and Democrats were picking up one Senate seat after another. At 8 p.m., the polls closed in Minnesota, and returns began to trickle in. How's it look? I asked Shriok. It's early, she answered, but it looks close. Precincts and counties continued to come in. How we doing? I asked Shriok. It looks like it's going to be close. As we scrutinized the Minnesota returns, Democrats continued to gain Senate seats and Barack Obama continued his sweep to victory. What's it look like? I had asked Shriok. It's going to be very close. The networks agreed with Shriok. A very close race in Minnesota, they'd say, between incumbent Republican Norm Coleman and former Saturday Night Live comedian Al Franken. This was beginning to become unpleasant. No joke. Then at 10 p.m. Central Time, as soon as the polls closed on the West Coast, the networks called the presidential race for Barack Obama. It was a stunning moment. Then the networks cut to a 250,000 people in Grant Park in Chicago going absolutely nuts. We could not take our eyes off the TV. That mass of people, all ages, all races, cheering, jumping for joy, waving sparklers, grinning, laughing, crying. I didn't know whether to laugh or cry myself. My God, he won. Obama won. And then he and his family took the stage. Pandemonium. We had a young, smart, cool, handsome president-elect. And he had a young, smart, cool, beautiful family. And they were black. Holy crap. I felt lifted, almost elated, but not quite. Why, I asked myself, why am I not euphoric? Oh, right. I was having a rugged night emotionally. I'd say the same was true for pretty much everyone on our team. But Shriok and Dan Kramer, the Wellstone alum who is running our field program, were all business, analyzing returns.